Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/Wondery, code Wondery.
Life is full of personal wins, whether it's cleaning your house, getting that dream car, or checking off your to-do list. Winning at life is a great feeling. And with the State Farm Personal Price Plan, you can keep winning when you create an affordable price just for you by bundling home and auto. So give yourself a round of applause. Talk to a State Farm agent today to learn how you can bundle and save with the Personal Price Plan. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state.
Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast. Hey, you guys. So there's no new All-Star Celebrity Bowling today. Season 1 ended last week. We wrapped it up 10 episodes with the Breaking Bad team. We will be back in a few months, so it is coming back because I get to make those decisions, and it's fun. I just like it. I like it a lot. So in its place, we actually have the Monday show on the Nerdist channel is going to be a show called The Realm of LARP, which is a fucking awesome show about a LARP. So, and we're not making fun of it like other jerks do. We are celebrating it because it's awesome, and the people are really sweet who are on it. So, Realm of LARP starts soon on the Nerdist channel on Monday. So just as a placeholder today, to put something up on the Monday, I stuck up a video of Matt and Jonah and I when we were driving from Denver to Boulder to do a live podcast, and Matt breaks out into song, and it's amazing. So that's over at the Nerdist channel right now, youtube.com/Nerdist. I would like to thank GoToMyPC.com for sponsoring this episode of Nerdist Podcast. Go to My PC by Citrix. If you want to be connected directly to your Mac or PC, that's great for you. But what if you're not at your computer? That is why you would use GoToMyPC. You can get it from your iPad and your iPhone too. Literally all of your computer files are right in your hand or your phone or your feet. I don't know how you operate your smartphone devices. I'm not saying you couldn't operate them with your feet, right? Your toes would work just fine on a capacitive touchscreen, so there's no reason why you couldn't use that and get all your files. You can work on any program or file or document and save it right to your mobile device. It just gives you freedom, so you're not always... Computers basically force us to work like machines, and this just kind of opens you up and gives you access to everything you need. So go to mypc.com today. Special 45-day free trial just for Nerdist listeners. Click the Try It Free button, enter the promo code Nerdist, and then you download the free app on your iPad or your iPhone. That's gotomypc.com, Try It Free, promo code Nerdist. This episode is Ray Romano. I love Ray Romano. He's a guy that for years I've thought was able to do really fantastic family-oriented stand-up in a way that doesn't feel like, oh, it's bubblegummy. Like, I love Ray Romano. And we got him on this episode with the guy who has been his touring partner for years and years and years, Tom Coltabiano, who also wrote on Everybody Loves Raymond. And then, I guess about 10 or 11 years ago, they just recorded this tour sort of right at the height of Everybody Loves Raymond fame. They went out and did a tour across the Florida and parts of the South of America. And the documentary is called 95 Miles to Go, and it's super fun. So I recommend it. And I recommend, but not before you listen to this. I recommend this first. So here is the thing that I'm recommending. I am very biased because it's my thing. So is it all right that I'm biased for my own thing, Katie? You're just nodding.
Yeah.
Thank you. Everyone's going to think Katie is this weird alter ego that I made up. Yeah, just me and Katie hanging out tonight. Just silence. Right. Yeah, Katie, why don't you order the lamb? The sky's the limit tonight. Thank you, Katie Levine. Here's the Nerdist Podcast episode number... oh, let's say 217. With Ray Romano and Tom Coltabiano. Two nice Italian boys.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
So these microphones, you kind of have to get up on them.
Yeah. No, I won't be sitting like that. I'm resting up when we start.
This looks like a weird trust exercise.
We're trusting each other.
Where you have to share. It's a sharing exercise.
Actually, we got into a fight and we had to go to court and they said this is
and
what
this
we have
was
to
this
do.
Is a court ordered. Yeah.
For 2 weeks we have to live like
you
this.
You just put it on your other ear, on your inner.
That's what I was telling him.
Oh my God, you guys.
Way Logic Romano.
All right, we're recording. We have started.
We're on.
I don't hear anything.
This is it.
Oh really?
Yeah.
You can't hear anything? I hear you.
I hear it.
Oh, headphones.
Right. One channel, then.
I think it might just be one channel in those earbuds.
What is it? Seriously, is this these
That's
guys have to stand like this?
Yeah, you know, it's awkward for everybody.
I could take that chair over there.
Listen, it's by order of the courts, Tom. I don't know what to say. I mean, I'm not. How can I challenge their authority?
Scoot down?
Why don't we bring it? Yeah, why don't we
share? Slide down. Yeah. Slide down. Slide down. Thanks. Is that because Tom's here?
It might be because Tom's here, but I don't want Tom to feel bad.
But wait a minute.
Tom is welcome.
Or, I like that you've never had more than one guest. Like, that's the theory.
No, we've done it before.
We've done it before. They just kind of crowd around there sometimes, and then
well, I assumed you've done it before.
Sometimes we'll take off and no one notices. It's great.
And then
I can take a nap underneath the table.
Matt will slowly just gingerly place his butt to just kiss Nick's shoulder.
Yep.
Yeah.
While Nick, don't worry about it, Nick. Everything's fine. And then it's awkward for everybody.
Butt kiss.
But it's really nice to have you here. I'm so
thank you.
It is a thrill to have you on the little podcast.
Thank you.
I remember, I think the first time I ever saw you, I always talk about the Young Comedian specials, and it was the one that you did with, I think, Kindler and Janine and Judd Apatow, and I think maybe Bill Bellamy.
Bill Bellamy and Dana Carvey was the host.
Yeah, that's, did they split up the hosts that year, or was that, did Dana just host that one?
No, he hosted the whole show.
Yeah.
It was in San Francisco. No, it was in Arizona, I remember. Yeah, we were in Arizona.
Was it at the Tempe Improv?
Was it?
I'm 90%
no,
sure.
I think it was in a theater of some kind, wasn't
it? I'm 40% sure.
It looked like a comic club. I just actually
you just dropped 50%.
It's on HBO Go. You can stream all those Young Comedian specials on HBO now. Yeah. And like I watch it and Dana comes out just doing pretty much every character from
Chopping Broccoli.
He just chopping broccoli, does the church lady, starts with Garth, and then works his way into
Can I tell you why that's a good idea? Because his job as the host is to work the audience into a frenzy.
Oh, yeah. They went apeshit.
So that's...
Yeah. That was 17 years ago, maybe, I think. Bill Bellamy is a father at the school now, at the school that my kids go to. And he looks exactly the same. I'm not kidding. He doesn't look like he's aged a second.
He's dressing the same, too, huh?
Yeah,
shoulder pads.
Yeah.
He's like... His skin is just like... It's just like pottery. It's just beautifully painted.
Yes. And Judd Apatow was doing stand-up then. Yeah.
And I feel like it was not that long after that he did not do stand-up anymore and then just kind of focused on writing.
Yeah, I didn't see him after that. We didn't. Our paths never crossed until that. I don't think I had ever met him till then. And Janine Garofalo and then Kindler, of course. I know Kindler pretty good. He was on Raymond. He played a character on Raymond. And are we forgetting anybody? Wasn't Nick DiPaolo? Was Nick?
DiPaolo? Oh, I think maybe Nick DiPaolo was on too.
Yeah.
I mean, it was an amazing group of people, but I think right around that time is when the comedy bubble started to pop a little bit, because I don't know if there were too many specials after that one.
Yeah, that probably had peaked already. The comedy boom. Yeah, that was. I don't know. I also did a half hour that came after that. I think I did an HBO half hour special.
Yeah, that was like 95.
It was definitely after, because I remember we were thinking of the, we were trying to come up with a name for the TV show when I was filming that one. That's the one that was in San Francisco, the half hour. And I remember we were stuck on Everybody Loves Raymond for the pilot. We had shot the pilot, and I think it got picked up, and I was so tortured by the name, Everybody Loves Raymond. And I remember that's where my manager was there, and I was just obsessed with it, and I was thinking about it. I was in the green room, whatever. And Les Moonves had said, Ray, come up with a different title. Come up with a better title, and we'll test it. Because they loved Everybody Loves Raymond, the title. So I remember I just scribbled on a piece of paper like seven alternate titles. And I remember walking in I was in my dressing room and my manager was in the green room. I just went in the green room and I threw it at my manager. And he still has the little crumpled piece there. And it has where it has titles like Raymond's Tree, like like the family tree.
Yeah.
And then the one I like, Raymond, U.M. comma Raymond. Yeah. Because my manager told me, whatever you do, make sure your name is still in the title, because that was so, you know, for business reasons, it was very important for career reasons. And that's Raymond or all this crap.
That's so Raymond.
Yeah. That's so Raymond.
What was the one? There was one that I thought.
There goes Raymond.
No, I don't know.
I have, by the way, I brought a book. We did a book on There Goes Raymond, and there's a picture of that. Scribbled
oh, you have
piece
that?
Of paper. Yeah, yeah, which looks it looks like a mental patient is just trying to write.
Just angrily like, I will give you another fucking title.
He was so tortured by it because we were in a hotel room in Vegas, remember? And what Les Moonves said to him is, look, Ray, if it becomes a top 10 show, then you can change
No. I said to him, I said, Les, and this was, we didn't know any, we didn't know anything about the show. And I said, Les, and I was kind of just having fun with him, but I was saying, Les, this is going to be a top 10 show, and I'm going to have to live with that title for the rest of my life. Just trying to appeal to him with humor.
Sure.
It wasn't going to be a top 10 show as far as whatever. And he said to me, Ray, if it's ever a top 10 show, you can change it to whatever you want. And like after year two, it was a top 10, and I said, hey, Les, how about? And he goes, well, you can't change it now. Yeah. In 2 years.
But I think Ray's beef was, as an insecure comedian, if the show sucks, which most shows are terrible. So Ray wasn't like, this is going to be a great show. Ray's like, it's probably going to suck. And then Everybody Loves Raymond is just such a target for every
single that's why Ellen didn't...
Even if it doesn't suck, it's such a thing.
Still
people,
a target.
To this sandwich. Day, people use, you know, well, not everybody loves Raymond. You know, if I do a movie or something that nobody
loves. Oh, right.
Loves. Yeah. The title came about, it was a sarcastic comment that my brother made in real life. My brother was a New York City police officer, and I was doing stand-up at the same time, and he would humorously play up the juxtaposition of the two careers, you know? And you know, he'd see an award I won or whatever or something, and he goes, look at Raymond. He goes, Raymond goes to work, and people cheer, people clap. Everybody loves Raymond. I go to work and people shoot at me and people hate me and spit at me. But everybody loves Raymond. And that got into the script. That got into the first draft of the script. That's the tone that it was meant. But nobody knows that.
Well, does he try to take credit for that now? Like, I named that show.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. He was single. He was divorced. He's still divorced. And he was, you know, going out dating at the time. And, you know, at first he was a little upset at the way he was being portrayed, because Brad Garrett brought this, he brought this hangdoggy Eeyore kind of thing to it. And that's not the way we wrote it. And that's not my brother. But Brad, it was magic. You know, we were blessed that he brought that and lucky. And so he was like, my mother used to tell me, Raymond, why are you making the brother to be such a goofy? You know, Richard's getting teased at the precinct.
Oh my God! Is it the fraternity of cops probably had a field day with that?
But after the, you know, I was telling, it's just a character, it's just a thing, and you know, being a single guy, and having this connection to the show and being the guy, it worked out well for him. You know, yeah. Everybody gets laid except me with fame.
By the way, Ray's brother is so intense. He used to. Do you know Tom Hertz, comedian Tom Hertz? He developed rules of engagement.
Okay,
he created
rules
of engagement.
Gotcha. Oh yeah, I do know Tom Hertz. Okay, yeah, he's a big showrunner.
Right.
Yeah.
So very funny guy. But we all played on the improv team. The outfield was me, Ray, and Tom Hertz on the improv softball team. And then Ray's brother had a team, and so he brought a lot of comedians over to the softball game. And so Ray's brother would be like, Raymond, we're down 5 runs and your fucking friends are doing nothing but making jokes. And they're comedians, Richard. What do you want them to do? We're playing softball, you know?
Yeah, he's intense.
Does he have any awareness at all? Like, is it intense funny?
Yeah, or no, he's funny. He's dry too. And he's since retired. You know, he did 20 years on the force. And he wrote a script. Of course, he started to write a script, and which I was like, oh, no, this is the last thing I want. But, I mean, to his credit, he got a movie made. The movie is in post-production right now. Some woman raised $800,000, and he made it in Florida. And
he's only three movies behind you.
Yeah, but he's not in the business. And now he's ahead of me.
By the way, I just remembered this story. Ray, you know the upfronts.
Yeah.
One time. So Ray's there at the upfronts, and it's limo and all this stuff. And we're down in the village, and out walks Ray's brother in real life is on like a narcotics undercover thing. And he comes out dressed like a home. Remember this? Because Royce took an amazing picture of.
Yeah, yeah.
Here's Ray surrounded by limos, and here's Ray's brother looking like a homeless guy trying to catch drug addicts.
No, they were catching.
You disagree with everything I say, Ray, and it's going to hurt my feelings.
There was these transvestite drug things going on. Yeah, yeah. And he happened to be at the place where we were going for the upfronts, and
it's an amazing photo though, because it's Ray surrounded by limos. And
did that make the tabloids? Ray Romano's brother lives in poverty, while Ray Romano lives high on the. No, he was undercover. Yeah. Yeah. Sure, he was undercover.
Ray Romano's brother, transvestite drug addict.
Yeah. Yeah. When did you start doing stand up?
I started in I was 23, the first time I ever went on stage, so that's 21 years ago, but then I gave it up. You know, I did kind of well. Then I bombed, gave it up for about a year. Went back, same kind of thing happened. You know, after you bomb a couple times, it scares the shit out of you. You know, you can. By the way, you can.
Yeah.
You can
say, yeah.
You can say bombing.
do not say bombing on the show.
All right. I count my official beginning as probably like 85-ish or 84, around there, maybe.
What was the comedy landscape?
No, yeah, maybe 83.
You talking about your first time at the Improv or that comic strip tape is 87?
No, the Improv was the first time ever on stage. Improv in Manhattan that doesn't exist anymore.
Oh, yeah, a lot of those great improvs don't. I mean, like, there are still improvs around the country, but there was a great club in Santa Monica and the one in New York and just all these.
Well, New York was the first.
New York was 64, and it was amazing when it's, because they used to do shows till like 3 in the morning.
They say New York, that was the first club in the country, but the argument is that Pips in Brooklyn.
Well, I'm just saying the Improv back then.
And so what was it? I mean, was there any sort of open mic scene at the time, or was it just like you audition to get on to the stage at the Improv and then that's
no,
a big
you
deal?
You audition to become the late night, one of the late nighters. You go on a Sunday. What happened was you'd go on a Sunday and pick a number, one Sunday a month, pick a number out of a hat in the afternoon, and they would give out 20 spots to go on that night. Audition night, and there would be 40 people there, so 20, you know, there'd be 20 blanks in the hat. So when I went, this was the second time I tried. I brought a girl with me that I worked with. She wasn't a girlfriend, she was just a friend, and I said, we'll both pick out of the hat. I'll have double the chance of getting a number, but if you get picked, there's a guy with a clipboard who wants to know your name for that night. I said, you tell him, if you pick a number and I don't, just tell him your name is Jackie Roberts, because he's not going to remember. They're not going to remember at night. You know, this guy's just the clipboard guy. So I'll go on as Jackie Roberts, an androgynous name. It could be guy, woman. She picked the number. I drew a blank. So I had to go on that night as Jackie Roberts, and I passed the audition, meaning I got to come back next month. But now I'm Jackie Roberts, and I passed again, and I became a late nighter for the first month, maybe. I was too afraid to tell him I'm not Jackie Roberts. So I was Jackie Roberts for the first month of my career. And then I told her, you know, that's just a stage name I was using, and I'm just going to go with my real name.
And now this other comedian, Jackie Roberts, actually gained consciousness and has had a relatively good career.
Who writes those kind of scripts? The guy who wrote adaptation.
Oh, Charlie Kaufman.
Yeah.
Everybody
manifested another guy.
Did you guys? Oh, this is about to get off on a whole separate thing. Did you guys do Raymond in Russia? Was that your story?
That was Phil.
Phil Rosenthal. It wasn't even Phil. Sony, who owned the rights to it for I don't know how that works, was selling it to Russia. Russia was going to take our scripts and do them just translate them and do the scripts word for word.
Sure, know? Because there's no more than just words.
Yes.
There's no cultural, there's no structure of hierarchy, of family.
By the way, I went to Warsaw, into the series, I went to Warsaw, Poland, and did Rules of Engagement in Warsaw, Poland last November. And they didn't have, if you've ever seen Rules of Engagement, they have a diner scene.
Yeah.
And the first day I'm walking in, and there's no diner. There's like, it looks like a nightclub instead of their daily diner where they have discussions.
Sure. School tick.
And so I said, well, where's the diner? And they're like, well, this is the diner. And I said, but it looks like a beautiful nightclub, and you're supposed to come in the morning and talk about your day. And there's a lot of scenes where like Spade will come in and drop down on in the booth and slide over. So I said, if nothing else, you have to have a booth. And they're like, there's no such thing as a booth in Poland. So I had to write an email to Rules of Engagement. To Tom and say, hey, can you get a PA to measure your booth and send it here? Send it to Warsaw, Poland. And their line producer started corresponding with me and saying, yeah, I don't know who you are. We can't send this information out, like the top secret what a booth looks like information. And eventually they had to send it over to Poland, and we built like the first booth in Poland.
I hope they get the internet over there, because that would solve literally everything.
Their economy turned around.
Yeah. There's still a plaque commemorating the first.
It completely changed their political structure.
No, but what you're talking about with the cultural differences, like Phil Rosenthal went over there and did Everett Raymond in Russia, and it became a giant hit. And
is it a hit?
They shot every episode we did, which was 210 episodes, and they're writing 60 new ones. So that's how big of a hit.
So then are you guys going to do the Russian versions again when you're here?
Yeah.
That documentary has so many like just really tense, awkward moments of just like, you know, Phil just trying to say what they should do and then everyone just hating him.
Well, from the you haven't seen it, Chris.
That one I have not seen. Okay. I've seen your documentary. I haven't seen it yet.
So in that one, in Exporting Raymond, if you want to learn about the business, it's a great movie because Phil, who knows what he's doing. Let's say he's an expert on Everett Raymond. There is nobody more expert than the guy that created and ran it for nine years.
How about Raymond?
You'll get a minute for rebuttal, Raymond.
Raymond?
So, but the bottom line is you're watching
Jackie Roberts over here.
Jackie Roberts. That guy, by the way, like he had a great act. But if you watch the movie, Phil is constantly giving advice. It's you consulting and saying, here's how I do the Chris Hardwick Nerdist show.
Sure.
Yeah, okay, Chris, we'll handle it for
right,
you.
Right, right, right.
We know how to run. And so Phil's constantly getting kicked in the balls. So that's what you're...
On
the outside, it's great because he's...
It could have been a Christopher Guest movie, like of just how it just everything sat and like just... Because maybe you shouldn't. And then they would like scoot chairs away from him.
They hated him by the end.
They hated him,
I had the opposite experience.
I'm curious to know, going back to the other point, who Polish David Spade is.
Well, can I tell you, I'm there for a month. I want to get back to our movie eventually, but I'm in Poland for a month, and at the end, you have a screening for the network executives, and they're really good. They were really on the ball in Russia, and they say, for this last screening, there are no such things as womanizers in Poland, and so... That sounds crazy, right? I mean, men are kind of men everywhere.
Sure.
Because they're all womanizers. So it's just the way they are.
Yeah, right. It equals out the curve. Yeah. So they're like, I'm worried about that David Spade character. This is the president of the network who's a smart guy.
And they literally just meant David Spade.
No, but they had it. They ended up having a guy who was a famous actor who did a great job. He was phenomenally. But their bigger concern was culturally, there aren't a lot of womanizers.
That's because there's no booth.
I supposed to move in on a girl when you have to scoot a chair over.
But
instead,
we solved that problem. Excellent call, that Raymond. Excellent, outstanding.
Yeah, all the pickup artists are going to Warsaw. You guys, that's where the action is. No one has been.
Nobody. Yeah,
this is an untapped vein. Right.
And by the way, what was your take on the women there?
What sign are you? Yeah, what sign are you? They've never heard. Like, the worst pickup artist from America goes over there. He's the king of the world. And the women in Poland are stunningly attractive. Like, from doing stand-up, the girls in Houston, the girls in Montreal, the girls here. And then you get there, it's kind of the same as any other population. Although I will say
Montreal's
great.
But in Poland, I heard the same thing. I heard, when you go to Warsaw, it's going to be... And sure enough, like, my interpreter was in... very, very attractive. And the guys were saying, like, thank God that there's just all these beautiful women, because we're all very unattractive men. But it doesn't. But there's no, you know. So it was, yeah. So they you know.
Oh, let me leave a message. Plan a trip to Poland.
Yeah. Yeah. Tell wife going to Jersey Shore.
Yeah.
So, by the way, Chris, you saw the movie.
I did see the movie. Yeah, and it's, so the movie was shot
years ago.
10 years ago, 11 years ago?
Season 5 of Raymond, yeah.
So that's really, season 5 is probably what I assume is about the time where you start to feel like the show's okay, we're on the air, we're not going to get canceled. You're just probably starting to feel comfortable at that point.
As far as not getting canceled, we kind of knew in year 3 probably that we were pretty safe.
But
you
can breathe. You know, it's Hollywood, so shit happens quickly. Yeah. And like, I'm the greatest.
But it was rolling. The train, yeah. The wheels. We were rolling down the track in season 5. Yeah. Everything was moving full steam.
I always wonder how you keep a show like that. I mean, I ensemble casts are, I think, make a show.
Yes.
And I think a lot of, you know, especially during the hey, let's make stand-ups sitcoms in the 90s, that whole thing, which you did obviously beautifully. But a lot of comics would get shows and then they just wanted to be the only focus of the show and not really have a great supporting. It almost felt like keeping a band together for that long. So how do you keep a band of actors who all have their own sets of baggage and egos and like, oh, well, now maybe we're famous too. Like, how do you keep a show like that intact for so long?
Money. Everybody, you know, the biggest stars were the parents. There was Doris Roberts and Peter Boyle.
The biggest stars when the show
started.
Began.
Yeah. I was an unknown. Brad was an unknown. Patty had done enough more than us. But we were, you know, I was just happy to freaking do anything, you know, and I was nervous as hell. I'm working with Peter Boyle and this and that. So I was happy to just be there. Having said that, you know, when it does become a success, it's business. It's business. And actors, you know, they want to get what they think they deserve. The network's making money. I start making a crazy amount of money. They want to get money too, and I don't hold that against them. And you know, there was some renegotiating stuff. There was a couple of tense times, you know, where people felt they weren't getting enough. But it kind of all worked out. But I don't, you know, I just feel like that's par for the course. That's just the way any successful show goes.
But I think Ray is a nice guy. You know, and so he says
you and those two guys.
Right.
Don't blame
that
him.
I agree
I do
with.
Not blame
he's
him.
Just saying what we're all thinking.
By the way, we got to get a picture of these guys. It's like, I love this. It's like a doo-wop team or something. That's
Ray and Harmonize.
But Ray set the tone on the set. So Ray was never a prima donna.
And Phil.
Phil and Ray together. It was just a set of people. So the financial stuff that Ray's talking about, there becomes a point just like with the Seinfeld guy, you know, it becomes a point where it's season 6, 7, 8, and they're known as these characters and their money is coming to an end. And they're kind of oddly like, you know, Jason Alexander kind of is known as George a lot,
yeah.
You know, for like, it's a kind of an albatross, even though you pray 10 years before the show comes about. What if I could put you on a hit sitcom? Oh, please, you know,
sure.
Do it. So there is that money negotiation at the end where the network goes, basically, where are you going to go? And the actors are going, can you please pay us some more? So it becomes, towards the end, this kind of tug of war. But as far as just personalities and on the set, great.
Personalities, there was never an issue there. Like the only issue, and it wasn't even that big, was negotiations. Yeah, like, but that's
normal.
That's
cash.
The way it's supposed to be, yeah.
Well, it's weird because you're in a creative business, and then it's also a business. So you have this thing where it's negotiation time, and now they say, hey, whoever, actor, you're terrible and we'll replace you in a second. And there was one time where we really, Brad was in negotiation and the call came down from CBS, write Brad out of the show.
Yeah.
Really? Yeah, so write him out. So we had to go in the writer's room and take him out of this script.
For an episode. For
an
one
episode.
Yeah.
Because they're like, he's...
Oh, they're trying to send a message.
They're sending a message. See you later, Brad. It's Everybody Loves Raymond. Here's who we don't need. Anybody
but
Raymond.
But by the way, none of the cast members were expendable.
No, right. I'm not saying that. I'm saying the business negotiation is, that's why you should name your show always Your Name.
Well, and that, but that's because I started to say earlier is that that's why Ellen didn't name her sitcom Ellen to begin with, because she was terrified that it was going to tank and then just drag her name in the mud with
it. But that's Everybody Loves Raymond's fear. But it is true. You know, you become...
The fear wasn't my show tanking. The fear was just people
using,
as a comic, first of all, the last thing you want to even think is that everybody loves you. Because the thing that makes you become a stand-up comic is you think everyone hates you.
Yeah. Yes. And no one wants to watch a comedian talk about how
popular and
I know it was done tongue-in-cheek and all that, but
nobody knows
that
at the beginning.
Well, you know from being a stand-up that no matter how ironic you think you're being, there is a percentage of people that'll be like, why did you say that?
Oh yeah.
Like, no, it's a fucking joke. It was obviously a joke.
Well, like Louis C.K.'s album. Like, he calls his album hilarious.
Yeah.
And that's just kind of just tempting people to just say, well, this is truly not hilarious.
I think it's always funny when you're negotiating, like when you get a job offer and you're negotiating, my manager and I have this joke that the producers and the network will tell you that you're amazing and then turn you over to business affairs, and then they will tell you why you're not necessary.
Yes. That's exactly
so that they can negotiate. Yeah. So it's this sort of weird, you're amazing, but not really.
Yeah, there's a
you're
thousand
amazing,
like
but
you
replaceable.
Out there.
Yeah, at the same time. And we also have this weird dynamic where it's we're weird about talking about money in our culture. Like, you can talk about the lowest salaries and the highest salaries, but you can't talk about the, like, if you make minimum wage, you go, I make like $7 an hour. Or in your case, when your salary is being published, they're like, oh, he makes money per week. But if you make like $100,000, it's a weird thing to talk about with people for some reason. It's only the lowest and the highest amounts.
Yeah, yeah. You mean it's off. I remember Neil, you know Neil Brennan?
Yeah, very well.
Okay, so Neil, I remember I saw Neil at the Comedy Magical, because Neil used to be, when I started, he was like handing out flyers at Boston Comedy Club in New
York.
As
a teenager?
City. Yeah, yeah, in New York City. Well, his brother, Kevin, was doing it for a while, but then he was there. And I ran into him at the Comedy Magic Club, I don't know, whenever it was now, 5 years ago or something. It's weird, because all of a sudden you move to Hollywood and you can't, there's a potential to get a lot of money all of a sudden where you don't even want to mention it to people. Like, there's... I had a friend who sold a pilot, and she's like, Tom, you're the only one I could call to share with, not because I like you, but because you're the only one who was earning a living, so my other friends wouldn't be jealous.
Well, you know? and it's also, because even, I'm sure there's, you know, as a performer, like when a friend of yours hits it big and you're struggling, you are definitely happy for them, but it's also that... It's also a mirror where you're like, fuck, that's what I want, and I'm not there yet. And it just gets into your head.
Well, it's weird with Ray's success, because we, like, even now, some people listening now will be like, hey, whoever the guy who's not Ray, shut the fuck up. Let me hear Ray. But, you know, we've been friends for so long, way before he was famous. So he's just Ray, my friend. But then, you see, once he becomes crazy famous, the effect that it has on other people. You know, this weird, there's weird people who feel like they're entitled to, like, I knew you when, so I'm entitled.
Or they'll
somehow
tell you that you have not, and I'm not saying this has happened to me, it is definitely not, but, or I, what I assume happened is people go, you've changed, man. You're like, I'm not doing this, I haven't done anything.
Yeah.
What did I do?
The thing is, once you reach that certain point, everybody kind of wants to be there with you, and you just don't have time for everybody. So that's the one thing I had to learn, was the old saying is, you can't please everybody all the time. I mean, as a comic, you kind of, the way I am, I don't want any confrontation. I want to please everybody. And the one thing I had to accept in this business when you reach a certain point is that ain't going to happen.
Right.
You know, you're going to disappoint some people, and there's nothing you can do. You got to accept it.
And do you feel...
You were looked alarmed there, Raymond, at the guy walking by.
It looked like, I don't know.
Somebody looked like a guy 2 weeks ago.
That guy... I didn't see anyone walk by.
I think, by the way, nobody cares looking in here. I realize they see you, like, walking by this glass booth that we're in. Like, people kind of like, oh, that's Chris Hardwick, and there's Ray Romano. I don't know, what am I going to have
also,
lunch,
there's a rule that if Seacrest wasn't here, you can't make eye contact.
He'll attack you if you do.
Was he here?
That's true, by the way.
Yeah. He did his show from here?
Yeah, and they built a whole new studio
Oh, that's right. This was the initial.
Oh, I thought he owned the building, but
he owns probably a large part of the building.
He owns the town,
but it's But occasionally, you'll see like Joan Rivers will walk by and wave, and you're like, "Oh, it's Joan Rivers," who still only flies out, who flies out from New York every week to do that fucking show. Yeah. She's like 80 years old.
Yeah, that's funny. By the way, just sorry off of what Ray was saying about like you learn you can't please anybody, and you know, with certain notoriety, all of a sudden someone's writing their request from, let's say, Ray, and it's like, can you speak at this charity? Can you speak? And it's like, he would like to speak at every charity, but there's a stack of all these equal, for the same day, for example. Like, even, like I would have friends like, I think Ray would play in this celebrity charity tournament for him. I'm like, he probably would want to, but there's 9 other offers, and he also has a family and a life. But from their perspective, it's like, it would kill him to do one.
Oh, why do you hate sick kids, Ray?
Yeah. You're against helping children. All right.
I'm curious. I would love to know what happens. Because as a young comedian, you have this idea in your head of, here's a thing that I want to achieve. Whether or not, how specifically did you know what it was that you wanted to achieve? Did you know you just kind of wanted to be a bigger
stand-up? I just wanted to do stand-up.
Okay. Yeah. So you achieve, you know, like what almost very, but very few people will ever achieve in terms of like making a name as a stand-up. I mean, did it feel like what you thought it would feel like, or how quickly did you kind of go, ah, fuck, this didn't solve all the problems I thought it was going to solve. God damn it.
Didn't fill that hole.
No, the hole is never filled.
I thought he was making a request over here. I was afraid to turn around.
That should have been the name of it.
Like, it's a smile and a point.
Like, the hole is never filled.
By the way, that's the name of the next book. And if I ever write out a book, the hole is never filled.
The hole is never filled.
Yeah. My days as a strip club manager, I don't know.
I think it sounds like Courtney Love's biography.
Nice.
See? Because of her band.
But yeah, that's it is a weird thing. Because you're getting all this stuff and you're getting adulation and all that. And and that's kind of subconsciously, that's why you're doing, you know, there's that need. There's that need that makes a person get up on stage and they want to be accepted and liked by everybody. And you're kind of getting it, but it doesn't end, though. It doesn't end. I've said it before. One hug from my father, and I don't have to sit here and do this shit.
Didn't he hug you once, ever?
One time he hugged me. It was very odd. Very uncomfortable.
He's been chasing that dragon ever since.
It was very uncomfortable.
Get back to that place, man.
Yeah, it was uncomfortable.
What was uncomfortable about it, though?
Probably the nudity.
These guys, well, they were... I was just trying to set up a joke there, and you guys were...
No, that's all right.
But it still worked. I don't think carried through.
Sorry, I didn't mean to step on your guys.
Am I killing your sideline, by the way?
No, it's fine. Man, I get to look at you too.
But you guys are really in the documentary. At the end of the movie, you're coming out together and fielding questions, and it's a totally different dynamic because you're playing off each other, and it's fun. It's really fun in a way that I think stand up can be fun sometimes, but not always because you're just like having another guy out there that's your buddy and.
I think you referred. So we did a movie, 95 Miles to Go.
95 Miles to Go about your tour, about Ray's tour.
By the way, that couldn't be more of an indie movie in the truest sense. In that, even though it's Ray, a famous guy, it was literally we took a film student.
It's so funny you're saying how indie it is. Indie. My younger brother said, well, "What are you guys doing?" This is when you were working on the extras,
right?
The extras for the movie. And I go, "Well, I'm working with Tom. He's making extras for the movie." It was extras for me. He goes, the movie is an extra.
I think he said he's doing behind the scenes stuff. He's like, isn't the movie is? But yeah. Well, it's actually a good story if you're doing kind of, if you want to do something yourself, right? So from the outside, it looks like, oh, Ray said, I want to make a documentary, and it happened. And
I was the opposite. I said, I don't want to make a documentary.
And it still happened.
And it happened. That's what happened. Yeah.
Well, no, what happened, an interesting story in that, I've been filming me and Ray on the road forever. And so one year I said, Ray, let's do it for real. So Ray's manager said, okay, let's get like the Spielberg of documentaries involved. So we have a conference call and, you know, she says, okay, what are you guys doing? I said, well, we're going to fly to Miami and then we're going to drive every city up to Atlanta and do a tour. And she said,
This is the documentary woman.
This is the documentary woman.
Not my manager.
Yeah, not the manager. Yeah. And so we know we're excited about it. We're gonna make it. And she's like, I see no reason to shoot this. Yeah. Unless Ray gives birth to a child or walks on the moon, no one's ever gonna watch. Like, shitting on. And we were like, I even said on the phone, I go,
and I said, we should be filming this right here.
Well, I said, should we cancel the tour also? Because she was just so negative.
I think I know who it was that you talked to.
I don't want
to
say her name because she's so big and powerful that...
I don't even remember who you're talking about. I don't even remember the conversation.
Yeah, we're on a conference call. Yeah, because Rory, Ray's manager, was being helpful.
Is her mother famous?
Maybe.
Okay.
We can talk. Yeah, we can talk after. But anyway, so I said, all right, Ray, let's do it anyway. What the heck? And so then they were going to do, his manager again said, well, we'll get the crew that does Taxi Cab Confessions. And they have lipstick cameras. They'll have a crew following you everywhere. They'll change out tapes. It'll be great. And Ray's like, I don't want to do the movie, Tom, but I really don't want to have a crew follow me around.
I wanted to relax. We just finished filming. I wanted to just get, you know, I had three little kids. My wife was letting me go away for a week. I just want to relax and play golf. And this guy wants, Michael Moore to come with us.
But Michael Moore was a 20-year-old college student, Roger Lay, who was in a USC directing class that I took. So I said, Roger, do you want to go with us on the tour? So we did. I said, you just got to crouch down in the back seat the whole time and not be
little
seen.
Kid, little, like, he looks like Topo Chico, you know?
Yeah, he's, yeah. Yeah.
Okay, Ray, action!
By the way, he's a great kid. Great kid.
Yeah,
great,
he was supposed to come. I don't know where he is.
Yeah, and he did a great job.
He loves your podcast, though, so he was like, so anyway, we shoot it, and, you know, the end of the story is we shoot it, we set up an edit bay, we edit it. 3 years later, we have a big screening. HBO comes. HBO pays a decent amount of money to air it for 3 years. So the person at HBO said, never, do not think this movie is a waste of time. They end up buying the movie. Mm-hmm. And so in between then, and I guess the point is here, you think from the outside. Ray just said, make a movie. So it was made, and then it happened. Still, there's always that obstacle in the way of, like, it's so hard to get stuff done, especially in Hollywood, where there's always an agent or somebody who's saying, don't do it. It's a waste. How are you going to sell? You know, it's amazing.
Well, look at the last TV show I did, The Men of a Certain Age. No, I wanted nothing more than for that to keep going. And sorry.
That was a good show. Yeah.
It was a good show. I had a friend who wrote on that show, and it just...
Who?
Mark.
Segman?
Yeah, Segman.
Oh, yeah. I love him. Yeah,
really funny guy. Yeah, and his wife, Kit, is hilarious, too. Yeah, like, they're funny. A funny couple, but not in the, like, look, we're comedian. Like, just funny. Just funny people.
Yeah, he's a good guy. Yeah.
No, well, I just thought of a Seinfeld story. Did you ever see Comedian? Seinfeld's
of course.
Comedian? Okay, so great movie. If you're into stand-up, that's a great movie for seeing, because there you see how laborious it is and just how unglamorous it is. Ours is a much more fun road tour, like you're out of the clubs and stuff, but you also see kind of the grind of it.
Yeah.
But when we were shooting our movie, the guy, one of the producers, Gary Striner is his name, we were in the Comedy Cellar, and there's a scene in the movie where Ray's talking to Seinfeld. I'm in the booth also. Mm-hmm.
In Seinfeld's movie.
Movie, Comedian. We're sitting there in this booth for a long time, and I became friends.
So you know it's not Poland.
Because they had a booth.
Because we're in a booth.
So
by the way,
automatically,
this I know.
Honestly,
that geotags.
That's the second callback, and it's 45 minutes. It still worked. You know what I mean? Like, when you're writing a Raymond script, you'd be like, I don't know if that callback's going to work, because the audience is 12 minutes later and whatever. So that's an awesome.
They actually don't understand who shot Abraham Lincoln in Poland.
Well, it's weird when you say Poland is a punchline already when you're there, because you're like, it's the Polish version of
John Wilkes who?
Yeah.
Sorry, I don't get it. Yeah. Ski.
It doesn't translate.
So the guy from Seinfeld, he said, I became friends with him, and they shot 600 hours, and I was saying to him, tell us your mistake. They were like a year ahead of us.
Yeah.
So I said, tell us your mistakes. And he said, the one thing that he did, which was really helpful, he said, you got to screen it for as big an audience as possible, as often as possible. Because when they sold Comedian, I guess Miramax wanted them to screen it for an audience. So they, you know, Jerry's like, why do we have to screen it, I guess? And they finally convinced him to screen. They screened it at Hoboken, 300 people. 10% of the audience walked out, he said. And they had this sinking feeling like there's certain scenes that people are really bored by. So they had to kind of go back in and cut out some of the boring stuff and add the funny part. Because that's what you're expecting funny when you see a Jerry movie. And he said, one of the guys, there were comment cards. And one of the comment cards was, you think this is entertainment? Give me $10 and I'll kick you in the balls.
Wow.
And so, yeah. And so...
I don't know why that's the alternative.
Man was Jim Norton.
He'll just kick you, yeah.
He meant it as a compliment.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a compliment, yeah. Well, it's interesting because we said, like, Ray and I were like, all right, let's cut out anything self-aggrandizing. Let's punish the audiences in the testing. So we tested the movie. The first version we showed was 2 hours. What you saw is 77 minutes, and mm-hmm. we shot 130 hours. And it was such a lesson for, you know...
Right, before you go through, we should also say... Comedian ended up being a great movie.
I love Comedian.
Okay, yeah. That was the process.
Yeah, well, the process of you, if you're doing comedy, which you guys are without knowing it, with those two earpieces. You know, if you're doing comedy, like you, it's that black box technology, which, and you learn that when you're doing a four camera sitcom. The audience tells you there is no more debate. The audience either laughs or doesn't laugh. Mm-hmm. You know, so you know that as a stand up. There is no, like, I'm going to argue about how good that joke is. Well, there is no argument anymore. As opposed to if you're doing a drama, you can have a debate forever about, and neither of you is right or wrong. It's like, okay, well, it's the absence of laughter is your, you know, your empirical.
But I also love, I felt empathy, but loved the moment when you're doing the corporate gig and destroyed. You fucking destroyed. And still there was a human I would consider you one of the cleaner comics in the world. You know, like I remember seeing you at the Improv like maybe 8 or 9 years ago and doubled over in laughter because you were as a cynical young comic, you made me laugh with jokes about your kids and your family. And the joke was I think it was just about how your kid can just repeat the word ladle over and over and over again.
Yeah. Entertain himself.
Yeah. I mean, and so to me, seeing this human resources person say, like, you know, you mentioned oral sex, and you're like,
that got the biggest laugh.
Huge laugh, and she was doing that sort of passive aggressive thing of like, well, it'd really have been great if you didn't do that part, but everything else was fine. I'm sure it'll be fine, and just kind of feeling so bad for you because I know when you do a corporate gig, they just feel like, hey, we're paying you, we fucking own you.
Yeah, I was tortured for a while there. If you saw in the. I couldn't let it go on the car ride home.
It was annoying me because I'm like, off of what you're saying.
What was funny is I couldn't let it go on the car ride home, and you were trying to talk me down. And as soon as you said, the woman who said you were cute, and I went, whoa, cute? All of a sudden, I forgot about that. Yeah.
It's just a weird thing as a comedian where, in your mind, your job is to make people laugh, and then when you do that successfully and someone else goes, you didn't do a great job. You're like, but I'm trying to...
What you're talking about in the movie is, what if you don't know stand-up, corporate gigs pay a ton of money.
Tons of
money. So you want to do a corporate... They're also the worst gigs you can possibly do sometimes. Sometimes they're amazing. And so they do, in a way, kind of own you. And there's certain comedians that just don't do corporate gigs because they're not going to... You know, they're not going to have Ray's reaction, which is, oh, I hope we're not in trouble here with that one maybe cleanest joke of a dirty joke that you're ever going to hear that kills. I'm really sorry. So the in the corporate world, it's like they have this feeling of like, we own you. And in a way, they do because of the money.
Do people even know when you say corporate gig, they may not even know what you're talking about.
Well, if an insurance company wants to have a retreat.
Yeah, they have all their employees there, and they hire a comedian to come up and entertain their company.
But you're coming on to their home turf. Yeah. There's a pre-existing...
conference.
A pre-existing structure of how they behave in their little world, and you don't know what it is.
Right.
And a lot of times they'll come up to you and go, you got to make fun of Ralph.
Right.
Because he fucking loves it. And then you do, and they're like, you shouldn't have made fun of Ralph.
Yeah.
But I remember in this one, the president of the company was up and dancing before I got on.
Yeah, he was breakdancing.
And the crowd was going nuts, and I was
By the way, you watching that from the outside, like how anxiety-provoking is that? Because I go up and open for Ray, and there's a crazy talented singer. It's like the worst case scenario of comedy.
You don't want to follow the music.
Well, you don't want to follow. By the way, I just thought of Ray had to do the inaugural ball for Obama. That was the worst gig I've ever seen for stand-up. Ray killed.
It was... Wait, let me say worst gig. First of all, it was an honor, so it wasn't a worst gig.
Well, who is he? Just the president of the United States.
Yes, he was... It was the night of the inauguration. But the conditions for stand-up were not the best.
Of course.
It was a big ballroom, people standing.
Yeah.
And stages here, stages there, and they're waiting for Beyonce.
Can I tell the story? Because I have to watch it.
Also, technically, the president had just been notarized.
The backstory is we knew Phil had met the president's wife, and the wife points to President Obama and says, "He's Raymond, you know, he's Ray."
They
so we know
fans.
He's a fan
they
of the
fans,
show.
Yeah.
So Ray has to, they request Ray to do it. So for like two
it's
weeks.
It's televised, it's on Channel 7, so, it's on ABC. Yeah.
So for 2 weeks, we're going to comedy clubs, and Ray's working out his material.
I'm working on my political, because you know how much of a political comedian I am.
So we go down, and now here's the setting. It's a giant ballroom. Everybody's standing, but it's like a conference room. There's no seats. Everybody's standing in a tuxedo.
Wall-to-wall talking.
Yeah, wall-to-wall PBI.
In the most uncomfortable shoes they can be wearing.
Yeah, true. And Ray has to go out, but the stage is behind him is scrolling the Declaration of Independence, okay, as it's going to go on. He has to follow Sting and Stevie Wonder doing a song. Ray now goes out after they do a song. So imagine following, who are you following? I'm following Sting, okay?
A dream away, away, away. Labels are weird.
You hate it when you're like, oh, I have to follow a guy who works the audience too much. No, I'm doing a superstar legend of rock.
Sure.
So now Ray has to walk out while he's doing his set. There's a performance of like Cirque du Soleil, people that they're prepping for. So there are scantily clad women being hoisted next to Ray on the ends of like the big velvet rope or whatever it is. So now Ray's on stage. So as he's saying, so anyway, there's a scantily clad girl on each side of him.
How about that president?
Being raised up. Halfway through his set, they accidentally raise the curtain on Jay-Z. So the whole audience turns is like, holy shit, there's Jay-Z. This is while he's doing stand-up.
Nothing to see here, folks.
So then he has to do his, and they don't mic the audience. So
we fixed it in post, though.
He actually did very well considering it was just a crazy.
Yeah, but you know what's so fun hard about comedy is, hey, here's music. You sort of have to pay attention. Hey, look, blinking lights. Hey, there's a famous guy that you know. Could everyone just listen to me? And it's very important that you listen to all the words because they really are the engine
and
behind
the
this thing I'm doing.
Yeah.
Well, that callback that he did 45 minutes later, that works perfectly because everyone's paying attention. Like you missed three words.
I think I kicked the wire out. See that wire? I kind of pulled it.
I can still hear you.
Everything's still fine.
Yeah. Everything's still fine.
The elevators stop, though.
People just start leaping out of the windows.
But, you know, they also picked me to do the Washington Press Correspondents' Dinner when Clinton was in, and it was right after the Lewinsky stuff. And it was only year two, maybe, of Raymond, or three. And no political stuff in my act. Nothing. Unless... You know, I can find politics in baby poop. There's nothing I can do. And I'm saying, why do they want me? That's why they wanted me. They wanted me because they were so afraid of putting anybody else in there because of what was going on, the Lewinsky stuff. And I thought, oh, but I got to go up and do my, marriage. And no, they want it. And it actually went really well. And when you watch on C-SPAN, it's weird because the audience is at mic, so it doesn't sound. But in the room, it went really well. This is one of there's a lot of surreal moments in my life. I have like the top five and easily in the top five is afterwards Henry Kissinger coming over and saying, very funny. Yeah, seriously. But the next day, I got shit in the on the internet about not being political. Because and in hindsight, I don't think I would do it again because that's what
they
thing
want.
Is.
Yeah,
that's what
yeah,
it
yeah.
is. You they know what I mean? Yeah. it's tradition.
Everybody loves Raymond, but Raymond doesn't love politics. That would be the
thing.
Yeah,
exactly.
Raymond, I want to tell you we are trying to have this movement to bring booths to Poland. I want to. It's years from now this will pay off.
I think it'd be really awesome if they had hired you thinking like, oh, he's going to do like family stuff. And then you just become like the edgiest, like, hey, smell my cigar, Mr. President. Fuck you guys. Oh, like, what happened? How quickly would the career have, like, do you feel that pressure of like, boy, I just say one wrong turn of a word and then that's it?
Oh, yeah. Well, I feel that every time I go on stage. Is, you could, what if I snap? What if I,
But that
was a nervous night. That was probably the most nervous I've ever been was going on.
For the president?
Yeah.
For the
having to follow
correspondence.
Clinton, yeah.
What are a couple other of your surreal moments?
Well, just, you know, doing the Tonight Show, doing Johnny Carson, hosting SNL.
How was the Tonight Show? I mean, it makes me sad that I will never, as Johnny Carson is one of the people, like many, that I idolized. And there's a weird kind of thing of like, and I'll never get to meet him ever. It's just not possible anymore. And never get to do the Tonight Show.
I got in just under the gun. I got in with, he retired. I did it in November and he retired in like, was it May?
May, the following year.
Yeah. And, you know, it's mind blowing because there are two things that I projected. And I did it almost humorously. And one of them was being on The Tonight Show. Before I did stand-up, me and my buddy Bill, I remember we were kind of drunk, and we were in our kitchen, and my older brother was, you know, I was his younger brother, so he didn't want to deal with me and my drunk friend. And we thought we were funny, and I said to him, Rich, in 10 years, we're going to be on The Tonight Show. We're going to be on The Tonight Show. And he said, yeah, okay. I go, pay any amount of money, any amount of money. And we bet like $50 that I would be on The Tonight Show in 10 years. And it probably took about 18 years after that. And I think we doubled to nothing every year. So I think I saved, if you do the math, I saved $4 million, I think. Yeah. But that was one thing. And the other one was playing at the Pebble Beach Pro-Am, because I used to watch it on TV and I was a crazy golf fanatic. And I told my buddy, another guy of mine, I go, I'm gonna play in that Pro-Am. He goes, yeah, there's no way. I'll bet you... I'm going to play, and I gave a time, like 10 years, I'm going to play in the Pro-Am, and I had no idea how, but the stipulation is I can play either as the amateur or the pro, so I'm not saying maybe I'm the pro in 10 years. Yeah. And I got to play in it. I mean, those were crazy moments that I got to realize. Well, the Tonight Show was just, I remember the day of the Tonight Show, I had only been doing stand-up 6 years, which, and how long have you been doing it?
Well, full time for 14 years now.
Okay, but so you know, it doesn't seem 6 years sounds like a lot, but
in stand up terms.
Yeah,
you're only just figuring out who you are at that
exactly.
point.
Exactly. So I was 6 years in, and I guess I kind of had my shit down. But now I can look and say how much better I got after that. But my daughter's 21 now. She was freaking 2 years old then, and I remember being in the hotel. I was living in New York, so we were in the hotel, and we were getting ready to go, and I had to go take a shower, and my manager went into my room. I took a shower, and this is the shower I'm going to take before I go on The Tonight Show. And I'm not going to masturbate. There's no way I'm going to masturbate, even though I probably should have, right? But I'm watching, and I can't feel my arm. I'm so... wrapped up in this, I started getting numb and I started to have an anxiety attack in the shower. Remember, calm down. I get out and we get into the limo and I can't shake it. I'm like, this is going to be a disaster. This is going to be horrible. And we drove about a block and a half away from the hotel and I'm freaking out. And I didn't, you know, your little crib sheet with all your notes. Yeah. I left it in the hotel. I go, oh shit, Rory, I left my note. I mean, I knew the set. I'd done the set a million times, but you want that paper.
Yeah.
I go, no, stop. And he stopped the car and I ran back to the hotel for a block, full speed, ran back. And somehow that physical release somehow calmed me down and I was able to get through it. But I was literally close to having a breakdown before getting there. But that was, I kind of got into this zone just from that run back and forth. And I was able to do it. And again, it's still when you're there, it goes like that, and you don't remember doing it. And it went well. It wasn't like one of these, you can't stop talking about the sets and he calls you over, but it went really, really well. And Johnny gave me this.
Okay. Yeah.
And then afterwards, I'm in my dressing room and I get a knock on the dressing room door. I'm like, how did it go? How did it sound? And Ed comes in first. Oh, that was pretty good stuff, son. You know, yeah. And, oh, thank you. Thank you. That felt good. And then it was Johnny. And he said, he shook my hand. And he goes, you got to be happy with that. I go, oh, thanks. You got to be real happy with that. I go, oh, thank you so much. And he left. And that was it. That was my whole interaction. Wow. And yeah, it was just.
But what's so crazy. Interesting about Johnny is that everyone, even you doing the A-OK to a comedian, everyone knows that means like, oh, that's the thumbs up from the emperor.
Yes.
That you just got, that anything he said or did was, there was like this sub language of like, this means this and this means this. And if he said, and if he looks you in one eye, that means this. And so, and he's just probably living his fucking life, but everyone's created this whole mythos around how what he really means by everything.
Drew Carey did it the week before me. And that was supposed to be my spot. And a couple weeks before, they said, can you do the week after? We're doing Drew. And I go, yeah, yeah. And Drew got called over.
Oh, he cried. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And I remember calling Drew after and go, you son of a bitch, that was my spot.
Yeah, Drew's one of the guys that's like, yeah, I did the Tonight Show on Friday, and by Monday, I had a career.
Yeah. By the way, I happened to be in L.A. when I was doing Carson. And so we went out the night before, and we know each other from playing on the softball team. And we went out. We watched Carson say Ray's name.
Well, let's say first, you're leaving out one fact. We went to, and it doesn't matter, we went to a strip club. We went to the Body Shop or whatever. And I remember
we were with Mike Rowe. Me, you, Mike Rowe.
A couple other guys.
Not Mike Rowe, the Dirty Jobs guy. There's another writer-comedian named Mike Rowe.
Writes for Futurama. Yeah. It was a stand-up.
Oh, wait, Mike Rowe's got twins now. You're outing him.
Yeah. Like no one's ever been... Okay.
Whatever.
We'll do damage control later.
But anyway, and, you know, we're just trying to pass the time, get my mind off it, and there's naked women in front of me, but... I say, let's get back just to get to the hotel to hear Johnny say, tomorrow night we got to.
Oh, that's awesome.
So we left some pretty good looking naked women.
Well, and I remember, so I go back to his room. By the way, there's Will Torbett, our editor, right there.
He just walked back.
I got to be honest, this podcast for the big publicity campaign for the movie, my editor who's 24-year-old graduate of NY Film, he's like, you got to do the Nerdist, you know? And of course, for that, they're like, the Nerd, well, you know, there's a weird, like, so we, and this is like a great show for us to do, I think, to be able to have this type of conversation where Ray opens up, because the other stuff.
Everything I've said here, I've said 100 times.
No, not yet. No, there's actually one story he said I've never heard. You know, Ray and I lived together for a year. The story about I'll bet you betting your friend. We'll be on the Tonight Show in 10 years.
I never told you that.
You never, I tuned out because it was so boring. Yeah. But so without that kind of push, I don't know that this would have been on the radar of the publicist.
Sure.
You know, to do it. So
they're starting to realize, like, hey, you know, podcasts are a pretty fun, you know, good way to.
But the truth is, I think you guys have these dedicated fans who really listen. And when we, like, we did the morning zoo type of tour, and it's just five, it's terrible.
Just because I know the stare, because I've done it before, but not as much as you, Ray, but just watching the hotel room in the documentary when you're doing the call-ins to the radios, and it's just like, yes. You got me there.
Well,
you
know, in the movie, he's in his underwear, and it's like 6 a.m. You have to get up and do this thing, and they're not really like, it's the opposite of this.
Hey, Ray, you ever see Doris Roberts' boobs? You ever take those out anytime?
Yeah.
Oh, please just kill me.
So I
please
literally,
don't kill me.
For this, I said to Ray, let's do this. Like, it's a fun thing where you can just talk, and there's no, and they really are students of comedy and stuff. It'd be a good thing. So that, you know,
I said, is there a,
you
like
said
a
please
fruit plate
no.
or anything? And
no.
Nothing.
Nothing like that.
Nothing at all.
That.
Yeah.
I got you a warm greeting. That was pretty good.
From me,
I thought it was a pretty greeting.
Better than grapes.
You did come
better
out
than cantaloupe.
Yeah.
I kind of wanted you to explain a little bit more because I think I know what you're talking about. And you referenced it twice in the documentary in 95 Miles Ago, but you say like, "Oh, I had one of those mind bets." Yeah. With myself, where if I finish this puzzle by a certain amount of time, then I wouldn't play golf. So what is it? Could you
as we speak, this is on my life. I don't want to say bad things, but this is I'm swearing to you on my life. As we speak, what time is it?
1:06.
I have 30 minutes until my recent mind bet expires.
What is it?
My penalty expires. No.
Oh,
so yeah.
Right now, I went golfing 2 days ago.
Yeah.
And I said, if I break a 90, I always write on the card what the target is, and it was 92, and I was horrible. And the penalty is 48 hours from the minute I hit my last putt of no TV, no golf, no betting on the. I was betting on the.
Ponies, dogs.
No, the
cockfights.
The playoffs. I can't bet on the playoffs. I can't watch TV in bed, and I can't watch TV in my office. And I was 1:35 when I walked off the golf course. So soon, I'm going right from here to the golf course. So it's going to time perfect. I seriously am.
A bookie jumps into Ray's car as he drives to the golf course.
Ray, I couldn't help but notice it's okay for you to bet again.
Yeah,
what do you like in game 7?
Yeah. Well, I make these mind bets because it keeps me out of trouble. It keeps me, back in the day, I bet too much, real money.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But that was back before I had money, thank God. And I found this kind of way to fill the hole, as we say. I'm calling back that one.
It is.
Yeah.
Fill the hole.
Fill that spot in the
booth. But it gets crazy because as you see in the movie, I got to watch TV in this guy's room because I lost the privilege of watching TV in my room.
It's weird because knowing gamblers, that feeling that you get.
Yeah.
In other words, from the outside, I don't gamble. It just doesn't interest me. It's just like, you know, he gets such a charge from gambling, and it's obviously not about the money in any way for
sure.
A gambler.
I get the same thing for the mind bets. When I do the mind bets on the golf course, it's like I got $1 million on them.
But it's interesting that you figured out a way to kind of harness that.
To save my wife's money. That's all it is.
Norm MacDonald talks about that a lot, like doing weird little bets to get away from betting big money.
It's like an OCD, like controlling your universe type of overall global
You the story. I've limited it to 48 hours, the penalty, the loss, because it used to be no parameters on it, and I used to say, you know, if I don't break 100, I can't watch TV until July, you know, whatever. And I would fucking ruin my summer. Yeah.
Because you stick to the bet. You have to.
Oh, there's no going back. That's what people say. Why don't you just go back on it? I go, no, that's not because I hold my hand. I swear to God and everything. I go, no, there's no going back. I'm too karma, you know, conscious. And I found I wasn't able to watch TV in bed was the loss. And by that I meant when I go to sleep, so leaning back on my pillows. So I found a loophole that if I lean up in bed, I'm technically not breaking my bet, my promise. But by the way, it sounds like, hey, that's great. You know how annoying it is? It's midnight and you're laying in bed. You got to sit up and watch it. You just want to lay back and kick back and help fall asleep. I have to sit up and watch the freaking whole show. And then one night I'm like, oh, Christ, this is torture. And my wife got in bed and she says, I want to watch The Sopranos. And I go, oh, well, I started thinking, well, this is her doing it. Yeah. So technically, I'm just a passenger here.
It's not
so
your fault.
I was able to lay back and watch The Sopranos. Oh, this is great. I'm laying back, watch The Sopranos. And then 10 minutes later, I turn over and she was asleep. And I had to sit up for the rest of the fucking show. Yeah.
I think you should hire an attorney to just find loopholes.
Yeah.
Ray, I've been tracking your brain. Yeah. I think I found a couple of loopholes for you. Here's what I think we need to do.
Since then, I amend it each time. But since then, I've gotten rid of that. I go, like, the next bet I'll make, no sleeping in bed and no loophole of leaning up. You know? Yeah.
Do you talk about this on stage at all? Do you talk about the mind bets on stage?
I never did it on stage, and we never did it in Raymond. We thought about doing it in Raymond, but there was it was a little bit
it was too esoteric and
too twisty.
You know.
But we did it in Men of a Certain Age. In Men of a Certain Age, my character had a gambling problem and started doing the mind meds. We had one whole episode where he screwed his friends up. Because I've screwed my friends up. I've screwed their vacations up. You know, there'd be times we'd be going to with the writers of Raymond to wherever vacation, and I'd blow a mind bet before I left, and I couldn't golf for like 3 days, and I'd tell the guys, don't bring your clubs. I'm like, yeah. And they go, you son of a bitch.
Raymond said another mind bet.
You see in the movie, he's in my bedroom on my bed. Like, that's not joyful.
Well, what's funny is to think about is, like, you're at the height, you know, like, it's really, you're in the sweet spot of the sitcom. It's season 5. You know, you're a huge comedy star, and you're in these crappy hotel rooms in Central Florida, sitting in a bathing suit on the floor of this shitty hotel, just like, I just gotta find something on television. Yeah. Are there any cookies over there? Yeah, I just want a cookie.
I want some
cookies. it was just such a
keeping it real.
Yeah. Were you surprised though? Because a lot of people get mad. Like, well, what did you really do? Did you go to clubs and you this or this? Like, that is the life. Like,
oh yeah, no.
Else.
I mean, I just because I know what it is, and there's no listen. As much as you're like, I'm gonna lead a swanky lifestyle when I make it. When you're performing in Central Florida, you get the Hampton Inn, or which is fine. Like, it's totally
great.
It's totally fine, but it's not. You know, it's definitely. And I know it's very cliche to say, like, yeah, it's not really an extravagant lifestyle. It's not.
It's not. It's not like a rock. Like, oh, there's groupies, and then you're in the limo, and there's champagne, and all stuff.
Well,
it's
just,
like,
you just go back to your hotel with creepy green carpet, and you just try to find some cookies and just, like, make yourself happy
bit. We had a pretty decent hotel room. Just it still was.
They didn't believe
in your room and watch TV.
Well, that's the annoying thing. Yeah. Is like, I'm on my bed and I'm enjoying my life, and all of a sudden it's like, hey, what's going on? You know, it's like, I know what that means. That means he's lost TV privileges. And well, were you surprised when he really does ship his golf clubs back? Like, that's taking it to the nth degree.
Yeah, because he says he can't
golf for the rest of the week. When am I going to carry the clubs around?
Yeah, no, we could have. Yeah, because people are like, he didn't really ship them. I'm like, there is nothing in that. Now, what about the water bottle scene where he, I don't know if you know, there's
oh,
a scene
Yeah, but I totally know he there's a water bottle on the table and he goes to pick it up and it's already open. And it's that thing of like,
the waitress brought it open.
Right, yeah. And so when you find an open bottle, which is so funny because really, technically, you could just stick your face under a sink and drink out of it, but we've become so protected and like, oh, but that might have things in it, and someone else could have put.
Well, the paranoia is someone's put angel dust or some crazy poisoning.
Well, it's just not. It's not that. It's
for
just,
anybody though.
If you're predisposed to that kind of like, you know, slight OCD, which I think a lot of comedians have, it's that you find yourself in a situation where you don't have control over something. You don't have control over where that bottle was. You don't know where it was, and it's unnerving on a molecular level because you just like. It's not even the reality of what if someone put that in. It's just that's I don't know
in
where
that moment. Well, you see how pissed he is at me. Like, was yours open? I think I don't know. How do you not know? Like, how do you not like he's mad that I'm not microanalyzing that? And then when I leave, by the way, you've edited stuff, right?
Sure.
That everything is made in the edit room for a documentary. And that edited together so well. And people are like, oh, you plan, you know, like there's everything that happened in that movie is 100% real, but it's made in editing. You're tweaking those moments. But that was real. The water bottle comes, he gets pissed. I leave. The waitress comes. He sells me out to the waiter. Did you
totally.
Notice that? He's like, yeah, my friend here's a little paranoid, so whatever. And so it's funny because he comes. He admits it right away as soon as I come back. You know, he's like, so they open the water bottles for you, and the waitress thinks you're crazy.
Why do they do that? Why do they open a bottle for you?
Yeah, they're just trying to help you out.
I know, but like you can't. It's one of those things that really doesn't need to be done. Is anybody like, hey, why are you drinking? I couldn't open it. I didn't have.
I don't know. This just has a barrier at the top, and when I go tip it back, nothing comes
my mouth
out.
Is still dry, and the water's lasting.
Plus, first click is very satisfying.
Oh, I'm curious.
You're getting a that's a different. By the way, there's another scene where Ray. We're
keep
sitting
out
in
of
hotel
this.
Room.
Keep out of this.
There's another scene where Ray, we're sitting there and I go, Ray, don't you want to take like $1 million? You know, we're sitting there, which is one camera, by the way, and we're swinging back and forth. Like we're eating the peanuts in the room.
Yeah.
And you see Ray kind of go, click. It's a little callback.
Just to see like, okay, good.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Now we're
happy. Because it's interesting because, I mean, I think there's a certain part of comedic neurosis in your act, but I think people would view you as a relatively You know, you seem kind of, your demeanor is kind of laid back.
Right.
But do you feel that, you know, a lot of the stuff, like you said, oh, we didn't want to get too esoteric or too... Do you have any desire to really talk about, like, how deep it goes?
At some point, you know? Maybe at some... in my career.
Yeah.
Maybe, you know, the next...
You're talking about on camera. You're talking about
In stand-up, like exploring, really getting, or do you think that people that come to see you are like, how come he doesn't just do jokes about the, you know?
Yeah, well, yes. My audience, I can push it as much as I can, and then there's a certain couple of things that my audience isn't expecting from me, and even if it's funny, and it's funny with you guys and funny here, I can't do it on stage. And I can probably do more now, you know, as we get farther away from the show and I get older and all that. But it's like, you know, Brad Garrett, I used to work with, we used to do Vegas together, and they just know him as Robert from the show.
Yeah.
And let me tell you, he couldn't be further from that in real life. Have you seen him do stand-up?
It's a phenomenal stand-up.
Yeah, he's like Don Rickles, he's boom, he's whatever, yeah. He's politically, he pushes the envelope and everything, and people are taken aback by him because they don't know. They're not ready for that. They see Robert. So it's not a burden for me, but there have been a couple times where I've said, boy, I wish I could do that on stage. That would be funny to do on stage, you know? And maybe, you know, I think when you get further away from what they know you by, maybe you can. I don't know. We'll find out. I mean, look, I'm running out of material, so I may have to go to the dirty stuff.
There are rooms that you could do, actually. If you want to do alternative rooms, you could do all that stuff. And just to satisfy that urge.
That's exactly what I did. When I was in Montreal at the Comedy Festival, eight years ago.
Did you do Kindler's show?
Yeah, Kindler had a thing. And I just went to watch, and I said, please don't make me go off. Please don't make me go again. And in between one of the acts, he said, you got to do 5 minutes. I go, holy shit. So I had to take out my thing and think of all the bits that I never could do on stage that I would try to do, and I did them up there, and of course they killed. Yeah.
But when you're like, oh, maybe I...
Yeah, but then they kill in that environment. Yeah.
P.S., there's no money in alternative comedy, but then, you know, like, maybe it's...
fun. It's fun.
Maybe it's just fun. Then sort of to kind of wrap it all up, do you feel like that getting, you know, huge amounts of success, does that reinforce the neurotic parts, or do you feel like you know, even if you had just been working a regular job, do you think you would have just been...
Well, I had a joke for this that I said on Letterman once was... You know, before all this happened, I thought my cab driver hated me, and now I think my limo driver hates me. It's kind of relative. It's kind of all relative. But having said that, I don't know, because I went through some neurotic, semi-heavy shit when I was before stand up and all that. You know, so I don't know if I think the good thing, the healthy part about this is. It's a great outlet. It's a passion for me. It's being creative. You know, when Raymond ended, I thought, oh, this is going to be great, because I've been doing stand-up for 11 years before the show started, and now 9 more years of Raymond. 20 years I've been working every night almost. Because before Raymond, I used to do stand-up in Manhattan. I used to do it almost every night. Now I got a little bit of this. I got some financially. I'm set. I can just kick back and let's see what happens. And let me tell you, after 3 months, I was in therapy 2 times a week. Not kidding you. I can't stay idle too much because I catch up with myself. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I like to work, and I need to work to feel right.
You know, off of that question about Ray. We were years ago, because their thought is, okay, you've made it now. Now is it potential? Because you don't have the normal money struggles anymore where you're like, okay, I have to do this. It's not like, oh, everything is possible, which means it could be a potential devil's workshop.
Sure.
You know, where you go crazy. But when Ray and I really first bonded for our friendship was like, I was traveling through upstate New York with a ventriloquist, and I don't like to name drop.
I should have that right away, you know.
I hope you were also performing and not just...
No. It was just a vacation. Oh,
okay. Well, that makes sense.
So, yeah, we're performing bad gigs, and we're doing a road tour, Utica, New York, and then to Burlington, Vermont, all this stuff. And I call up Ray because we're going to stop at the Montreal Comedy Festival, and I call up Ray in Queens just because we're friends, and I knew he had been there. So I'm like, Ray, where do you stay? Where do you stay when you're in Montreal? He's like, whatever it was, La Montrose or something. He's like, he's like, you know, I'll be there at six, you know. And I'm like, what do you mean you'll be there at six? He's like, oh, I'm flying there tonight. And so I said, oh, okay. So we meet there. We go to like Jimbo's room. I don't know if you know Jimbo's room in
Comedy
Works in Montreal.
Oh, yeah.
And we meet there. It's me, Ray, John Peasy, this ventriloquist. And we hang out all night long. And then we leave the next day. We go to Burlington, Vermont, whatever the club is, who cares. And my phone rings in a hotel room, and it's Ray calling me because we had talked backstage about some neurotic stuff. And Ray was going through this kind of tough thing, you know, psychologically. And it's tough because you got to open up to somebody. And we had gone through this kind of same type of thing. And so we started talking a lot about that. And I'm thinking, okay, here's a guy. He just had twins. You're on a stand-up salary, which, you know, there's unknown, like, oh, please let me have some gigs, you know, that are decent. And it was a tough, trying time. I thought, okay, that has nothing to do with being famous. That, like, that has no bearing on... So I think the potential for any anxiety or any breakdown or anything like that is always there with any of us, you know? And I think it's with the end of Raymond, that story he told, you're getting done with such a creative... output. You know, it's like when you do a show and you're it's done. It's like you're like, all right, I have free time or whatever. I think unless you're occupied and have something to focus on, it's just such a trap, especially when you're
I think that's kind of why I work 7 days a week. Well, I hate free time. I took a 2 week vacation and I went a little crazy halfway through. Right. I'm like, I don't feel connected. I'm not doing anything. What am I supposed to do with my hands? Like,
Why am I here?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's all shit.
But the creative juices, it keeps you focused. You know, it's like just it's. You know, it's a good thing that you found something or you know.
And it's torture, by the way. Right? Like, I want to write a screenplay. It's freaking torture writing, man. I hate it. But
that kind of thing, too, is a very specific kind of writing. It's not like, I'll just sit down, I'll write some jokes, you know, that I can get out whenever I want. Joke writing for stand-up feels very much like performing stand-up versus other types of things which have a very specific structure. Yes. Like, you can take hard left and right turns with stand-up.
When Ray and I wrote the season finale the first year of Raymond, and we're used to just writing jokes, just what you said. It's fun and like, oh, what about this? All right, I'll do that bit, and you're done. And now you do it that night.
That was the first script we wrote, was the season finale of season one.
Of Raymond.
We wrote it together. It was the first time I told Phil and I told the writers, I'm going to take this one with Tom. And we looked at that blank page. I'm not kidding. Remember, there was one time Brad Garrett was in the kitchen, the character, and we had to get him out of the kitchen. And it took like 8 hours to figure out how to get him out of the kitchen.
Well, we went, it's called Why Are We Here? And we went into the writer's
room. That was the name
room,
of the show.
Why Are We Here was that episode, the finale. And you kind of, from the outside, it's just like you're hosting a show. People, I can host a show. It's there's all this stuff that when you endow with your imagination, like many people, I could write a Raymond script. It's, you know, Ray comes in, he fights with his wife, and that's it. It's like until you're sitting down there, and it's such hard work to write. I mean, it's literally.
But by the way, let's give it its fair shake. It's also great when you write and you get something and you accomplish something.
Yeah.
That's a great feeling, too. So, I mean, I say it's torture, but it's a torture that you love to go through.
Well, you get a spark of an idea to write the script, and that's like, oh, this is funny now for, like, I've enjoyed
then
that.
Then it's all the
moment.
Details.
Then it's all,
it's all the details.
And then during the process of a multicam sitcom, like, even rehearsal, you're like, oh, day three, this is the least funny shit ever written. Absolutely the worst script ever written. Then the live audience comes in 2 days later, and then it comes alive again, and you're like, so it's all these emotions.
Well,
up
I think
and
that's
down.
I think that's where the stand-up that's sort of where the stand-up gene kicks in, is at a certain point, you know, because you're being forced into this, you have this, like, well, you got to do a show either way, so you can fucking figure it out, or, you know, you just have to figure it out. Right. You know that you, or at least you hope that you develop this faith in yourself, like, I don't know what I'm going to say when the time comes, but I've done this enough something is going to kick into gear and my brain's going to figure it out when the time comes.
But that's the argument for, that's a great point. That's like the argument for using stand, I'm not trying to sell anyone on stand-ups because obviously it worked out in Ray's case, but when you see a stand-up being put into a situation, you know the guy's going to fall back in his instincts and at least have survival instincts of, right, we'll make it funny.
Right.
You know, so in those situations, like when you have Ray, who, when we were doing the show, you could walk up to Ray with a joke and while we're filming, and he would be like, okay, instantly, and then say it now, you know, 3 minutes later in front of the live audience and kill with the joke. Like, that skill, that inherent timing is priceless. I honestly don't know why more stand-ups don't get shows, or you just go,
well,
okay.
They do. They got.
But there's only a handful that have become.
Well, because there's other ingredients, though. You know, you they have to have a certain persona also. They have to.
Well, you have to have act. Yeah. You have to be able to act. Yeah.
there's well, a lot. Yeah.
Well, we know it's all the magic, yeah, lightning in a bottle. Like, this has to be the president, right, of the network has to believe in you. Then, yeah, you have to have a good showrunner. All this shit has to happen.
Well, it was an absolute honor to have you on. Thank you so much for coming on, Tom and Ray. And 95 Miles to Go is the movie, which you can get on iTunes. And can you get on iTunes?
Not yet. Okay. The DVD just came out.
So the DVD just came out.
It's got 2.5 hours of special features.
So
on
where
it
should people go to get the DVD?
I don't know.
Okay.
No, Amazon, Target, any place.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, any place physical.
Thanks, guys. It was a pleasure.
I got 10 minutes and my mind bet's over. I got to get to the
car. Yes, quick, get him out of here before the next mind bet.
Yeah, all right. Thank you, man. Fix it in post.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
This episode of the Nerdist Podcast is brought to you by GoToMyPC. Go to GoToMyPC.com, click the Try It Free button, and enter the promo code Nerdist.
Gen Z high school girls have gone through a lot. So what could and did send a shockwave through a group of 50 of them competing in one of the nation's biggest scholarship competitions? I'm your host, Shimo Liai, and I'm going to take you behind the scenes of the Distinguished Young Women Competition. I was Nevada's competitor 20 years ago, but this time, a Supreme Court decision catapults all 50 girls into the center of a nationwide debate about their rights. These girls, who have spent months fighting to make it to nationals, are faced with a tough decision. Do they speak up for their political beliefs, or do they stay focused on winning the money?
I think it's going to get ugly.
Follow the competition on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can binge all episodes of the competition early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.